You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We're talking today to Maggie Toulouse Oliver, Secretary of State for the State of New Mexico. And we're going to talk about some of the nuts and bolts of our government, how it works, and why that's important to the rest of us. The office of Secretary of State varies from one state to the next. 3 of the 50 states in the U.S. don't even have one, and in the other 47 states that do have one, the responsibilities vary. Generally, the Secretary of State is in charge of elections statewide, and in some states, including New Mexico, they're responsible for things like campaign finance reporting, which means money in politics, and whether the money is being used according to the law or not. Today's show will be a bit of a civics lesson and maybe a little geeky, but please stay with us because this stuff is good to know. And also, I think it's important to get to know the people whom we have entrusted with some of the most important functions of our democracy, like voting. Welcome, Maggie Toulouse Oliver.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
So we are living in a country right now where there are very serious issues with voting, including voter disenfranchisement, stories of eligible voters who've been purged. That can change election results. There's voter intimidation, problems with voting systems themselves, access. We saw a lot of these things. And then in the last election, very serious, and actually before that too, but very serious questions about election security. Mm-hmm. One of the most important functions of the Secretary of State in most states in the U.S. is to oversee elections. They are administered by states as per the U.S. Constitution, as I understand it. It's not
correct.
There is federal election law, but it is your job to do that. So let's talk about, first of all, how much do the laws, the rules, the voting systems differ from one state to the next, and what does New Mexico do to ensure really accurate and inclusive voting?
Well, that's a good question, and I think if you look at the states as a whole, you'll find probably far more similarities than differences. I mean, most states, except for one, require you to register to vote in order to vote. Most states offer some form of, you know, early and absentee voting. In pretty much every state except for a couple, electoral college votes are distributed in terms of, you know, the popular vote of the state and all of those electoral college votes. So there's a lot that's similar, but I think as you rightly point out, there are a lot of differences. And I think that's where the point of view of the legislature and the governor and the chief election official of the state really comes into play. Here in New Mexico, we actually started working toward a more accessible, more voter-centric voting system. I would argue going back to 2002 when the first early voting law was passed, and then fast forward just a few years from that to 2006 when the state required paper ballots for every single election. And of course, the importance of the paper ballot system is to protect the integrity of the election process, make sure that votes are counted as they were actually cast by the voter. The voter can verify that by looking at their ballot. And then it can also be, the election can be reconstructed if need be, if we have some sort of challenge or failure with the electronic machines that tabulate the results. And all of those things set the tone for then several more years of really voter accessible, voter inclusive, and security focused legislation. And I think where we are here in New Mexico now is we're really one of the leading states in the nation with regard to not only accessibility, but to security and integrity of our election process. So I'm really proud of that.
Would you say that that is largely because of the paper ballot optical scan system?
That is certainly a tremendous component of that, because in addition to a voter being able to physically look at their ballot and put it into the machine, we are also able to audit those results by hand after an election. And we do a required mandatory spot check after every general election to make sure that those electronic tabulators, optical scan tabulators, did count the ballots as they were cast. That in and of itself, I think, is a huge thing that we have here in New Mexico that most other states do not.
Some of them are using like Windows
2000. I mean, they're using antiquated systems that are just so obsolete.
Yeah, they are. And I think more concerning to me personally is that a lot of states, not necessarily throughout the entire state, but in large counties and lots of different counties around the country are still using the direct recording black box machines where you touch a screen and then your vote goes into a, you know, a memory card. And you really have no idea at the end of the day whether or not that machine tabulated those results accurately.
You recently spoke up against a bill that would allow armed Secret Service agents in polling places. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that bill, where it stands now, what your concerns are.
So that bill was the reauthorization that periodically has to go through Congress for the Department of Homeland Security. Of course, when President Bush created that department, it does have to be continually reauthorized. And of course, what that really means is just that it has to have its budget approved. And so this little tidbit was tucked into the DHS reauthorization bill after it had come over to the Senate from the House. And it just a little tiny section that says, you know, armed Secret Service agents, of course, can go into the polling place if they are guarding one of their, you know, the folks that are assigned to them. So the president or family member or former president, something like that. But then in addition to that, it had this little tiny note about or by memorandum of the president. There was no clarifying language. There was no only in these certain circumstances or for these certain people. It was a really wide sweeping authority that was being granted to the president to just assign Secret Service agents to polling places. And whether or not that was the intent, and of course, we, and when I say we, I mean my fellow secretaries of state and I, we don't really know where that came from. We don't know what the impetus for it was. We don't know if it was something the president, you know, suggested to a sponsor, stick it in there. All we know is that we found it. And so where we are now is we are urging the Senate to strip that out of the bill because it's not necessary.
What are the dangers of it?
I think the dangers are that we have a citizen-run democracy. As you just pointed out at the top of the podcast, states run elections, and it's important to have this division of labor for a lot of different reasons, but mainly we want an independent election process. And in each and every state, in each and every polling place around the country, volunteer citizens run the polling places on election day. They conduct the elections. Of course, county clerks and secretaries of state and such like that supervise and assist. But we want this to stay an independent citizen-run process. That is crucial to the health of our democracy and to having citizen-run independent elections. And when you create a scenario where you can have armed federal agents randomly assigned, you know, at the whim of the president to a polling location, particularly in an election where that president may be on the ballot or there may be people up for election that the president supports or opposes, that's concerning because A, it compromises the integrity and the independence of the process, and B, because those types of folks at polling places can be intimidating, discouraging. A voter, you know, may walk up and see, oh, there's an armed guard posted here. Right. Do I really want to go into this polling place? What is this about? I don't know. Maybe I don't know a whole lot about voting. Maybe I've never done it. Maybe I'm intimidated by the process to begin with. It could discourage me from taking part in my constitutional right to cast a ballot. And that was concerning to all of us, Democrats and Republicans alike.
Especially in a country where there has been so much voter intimidation and still is unequal voting based on things like race, where you live, ethnic identity, and so on.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, think about the Jim Crow era. You know, think about the intimidation tactics that were used back in those days to deliberately keep African Americans from the polling place. This is just, you know, again, we don't know where this came from. We don't know if this is intentional or unintentional, but a lot of the problems that occur in elections are the result of unintended consequences. And so regardless of the intent, this is just a bad idea, and we really need to make sure it doesn't happen.
Election security is a huge issue that was highlighted during the 2016 election, but it's been a concern of really a lot of people who have been observing voting systems since the 2000 elections. There are numerous ways that elections can be hacked. There have been cases where, for example, one city tried to put internet voting into place. They had a computer science department check it, and they hacked the whole thing within 24 hours.
That was Washington, D.C.,
That was Washington, D.C., yes. And they substituted, they wrote in, I think, sci-fi heroes. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. But there are so many other ways that elections can be hacked. You've talked about what New Mexico does to protect against that. What about the rest of the country? I mean, you're in touch with people all over the country, with other secretaries of state.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that. I was literally just on the phone before we sat down here today with a small working group of my, a small bipartisan working group of my fellow secretaries of state. And we are looking in particular at a piece of legislation moving through Congress called the Secure Elections Act, which would codify some of the things that are already taking place with regard to, for example, Department of Homeland Security providing us with tools and resources to protect our election systems. But what we were trying to do on the call is to kind of get on the same page about, well, what is it that we need in our states? What is it that the federal government could help provide us in this area, in this cybersecurity or really just election security arena, that could be really helpful that we all agree on? So we all agree that something that would be really helpful, for example, would be these things called Albert sensors. And what you do is you hook up an Albert sensor to your network, and it can detect if there are attempts to penetrate or otherwise interfere with your internet systems. There are things such as, I think my colleague Connie Lawson, the Secretary of State in Indiana, suggested, wouldn't it be great if we could have video cameras in every voting machine warehouse around the country? Because even though that's something that we should have to make sure nobody can, you know, come in and out undetected, it's something a lot of places probably don't have, you know, can't afford, small counties or around the country. So there are a wide variety of things that states are and can be doing, but there are varying levels of how much has been done up to this point.
I find myself, I mean, when I read about the people who are, you know, whether it's Macedonian teenagers or Russian hackers or whatever, their ability to hack into even secure systems is legendary.
Yeah.
And there are people who say, well, you know, our voting systems aren't connected to the internet, but of course the ballot that is uploaded into those voting systems is on the computer of somebody who was connected to the internet. And so there are so many ways to get in. And I find myself wondering, like, okay, American Express has a really secure system. You know, airlines have a really secure system. They don't make mistakes. Is there an initiative to do that level of security in the United States? Would it have to be state by state?
Well, that's a good question, and that's one of the things that we're struggling with the Secure Elections Act. I am of the point of view that I think the resources and assistance of the federal government in providing us testing, system tools, other sorts of, you know, network hardening software and hardware. Those are all things that I would welcome here in New Mexico. And I probably wouldn't quibble a lot with however Congress wanted to say we need to use those or that we must use them. Some of my colleagues have a big problem with that. They're so concerned with the notion of the federal government intervening in state elections. And, you know, if you think about this, and Mary Charlotte, I know that you are a student of democracy and the history of this country. I mean, it really goes back to the founding. You know, we did not want, you know, a lot of the founders did not want a strong centralized government. They did not want a dictatory government scenario where, in this case, the federal government could come in and tell the states how to run their elections and tell them what to do. So there's this, I think, this constant, I would say, back and forth in trying to find the right balance between what the federal government requires and what the states are able to do on their own. With that being said, to your concern about security and being able to use a system like American Express uses or like airplanes use, I think one of the things that folks don't realize is that there is so much redundancy, and there is also, because of the decentralization of our elections, there are a lot more safeguards in place than I think folks realize or give credit for. And that's not to say it's a perfect system or couldn't be improved. But I think that elections, by their nature, by their decentralized nature, and by the fact that there are tons of checks and balances in every step of the process in pretty much every state, gives me a much high, me personally, a much higher level of confidence in their security than I think the average American might have right now.
How does New Mexico encourage voter registration? And what does voter registration look like? I mean, do we have a large percentage of people who are eligible to vote actually registered?
We're doing pretty well in New Mexico in terms of that. I can't remember off the top of my head what our voting age population is, but we have about 1.9 million citizens or people living in the state. We are hovering around 1.2 million registered voters, which means we probably have a few hundred thousand folks voting age population out there that aren't registered. So we're doing pretty well on that front. What we've done is we've continued to try to make the process easier by implementing automated voter registration at MVD, by implementing online voter registration, which we did a couple of years ago, which is working really well. And now where I think we need to go is to be able to devote more resources toward reaching out to and getting individuals registered through other state agencies, which we're not doing as well with, and also developing more community-based voter registration to kind of fill in the gaps where online and, you know, state agency registration aren't, you know, hitting everybody.
It sounds like pretty good numbers considering that there are people who are children, people who are immigrants,
right,
in this state. How does New Mexico keep up to date, like people who've died or people who've moved away?
So I'm really glad you asked me that question. We do a few things. For years now, we have received a monthly data dump from our vital statistics department, which keeps track of deaths. We also receive a monthly, if not more frequent, update from the Department of Corrections. As you probably know, if you're convicted of a felony in New Mexico, you lose the right to vote until you've completed the terms of your sentence and probation and parole. So we have done okay with that, but it hasn't been perfect. We last year joined an organization called ERIC, which is a consortium of now 23 states and the District of Columbia. We all share voter registration and other government data with each other, so for example, motor vehicle data, and we track now between each other whether or not a voter has moved into New Mexico, moved out of New Mexico to another state. If they need to be added, we will reach out to them and say, hey, it looks like you just moved here. Would you like to register? If they've moved to the other state, we'll reach out and say, hey, it looks like you moved out of the state, would you like to be taken off of the voting rolls? And if they move in state, we track that as well. So we're actually doing a lot better now that we're sharing data with other states to really keep the lists a lot cleaner and more accurate. And of course, online and motor vehicle being automated really help with that as well.
In Florida, I mean, notoriously in 2000, tens of thousands of people were purged who shouldn't have been purged. How do you, like, let's say John Smith moves from
right.
New Mexico to Arizona.
Right.
How do you know it's the right John Smith?
So the thing that's really cool about this consortium, and I'm not sure if I mentioned it, it's called ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center. We have really sophisticated algorithms that are used to match up a wide variety of data. So it's not just a person's name. It's not just a person's name and year of birth. It's also whatever piece of their social security number is available from voter registration or MVD data. It's addresses that have been previously associated with the individual, if those things are matching up. You know, in the case where there's a full date of birth that's available to compare that. And then what it will do is it will, for matches that are what we call low confidence, in other words, they have the same name and we know they have the same year of birth, but we can't find any addresses in common or anything like that. They won't say anything to us about that because the likelihood is that it is a different John Smith or Jim Smith. But if there's a lot of different data points matching up where we can have a high level of confidence, that's when we will work to do the outreach to those individuals. And if we get what we call a strong match on a death file, for instance, now we're getting Social Security master death file data. When we can make a strong match and be sure that it's that person, we can just remove them off the rolls. But we won't ever do it unless we have that strong match.
Native American voters have made great strides in the last, 50 years or more toward enfranchisement, but there are still challenges for Native voters, also for some rural voters. What can New Mexico do? What are you working on to make sure that Native people and rural people can really exercise their vote?
That is such a great question. And we have such a unique history here in New Mexico. You know, we were ironically one of the last two states to really fully grant voting rights to Native peoples in the state. And we have a World War II veteran, Miguel Trujillo, who brought the original lawsuit against the Valencia County Clerk back in the 50s to thank for that. Here in New Mexico, what we're still seeing, especially in our rural tribal areas, is a lower level of participation in the election process. So, for example, if you look at the 2016 election, we had a 62% turnout statewide. If you look at precincts in rural tribal New Mexico, the average was about 56%. And okay, some people would look at that and say, oh, hey, that's pretty good. That's pretty close. What I see when I see that is that 6% fewer of those rural tribal voters are participating relative to every other type of voter in New Mexico. That is a gap, and it's a significant gap because when you consider that many elections are won and lost by even less than, you know, a percentage point sometimes, that can make a huge difference in the outcome of elections. And what that's telling me is that our tribal voters are not having their voices heard in the same way that the average New Mexican is having their voice heard. And so therefore, they're not being represented in the same way, because it you know, that's just the way that it is. Elected officials are responsive to their constituents, and in large part, their constituencies in their mind are the folks that are turning out to the polling place to make their voices heard. So we formed the Native American Voting Task Force this last year. We tried to have it passed by legislative memorial, and unfortunately it failed, but we worked together with the sponsor, Representative Lente from Sandia Pueblo. And now we have this group that's meeting with our office on a monthly basis and helping us figure out language and culturally specific ways of reaching out to voters in tribal New Mexico and talking to them about the importance of the election process. They do pretty well where voter registration is concerned, but then they don't necessarily turn out to the polls. So where is that disconnect? Is there a lack of trust in state and local government? Is there not a voting culture in that particular tribal area? For example, some tribes appoint their leadership by a group of elders as opposed to having a tribal-wide election, right? So there are challenges to be overcome, and we're working together with these representatives from tribes around the state to figure out how best to do that and how to talk about it and encourage that participation.
You just made some changes that would make it easier for blind voters to vote. Tell us about that.
Yes, I'm super excited about this. We successfully passed legislation in 2017. Let me back up a little bit. Every polling place in the state of New Mexico, as required by federal law, is ADA or accessibility compliant. So any voter with any disability can go to a polling place and cast a ballot independently if they choose, or with a person of their choice. But the problem has been that they haven't had that same luxury in the comfort of their homes. Blind people necessarily need a physical assistance to help them mark a paper ballot. That's just a paper ballot that's mailed to them. And so what this bill does, and what it will do starting for the primary election, is it allows county clerks to email a ballot to a blind or visually impaired voter, and it allows them, using their own technology at home that they already use to interact with the internet, to mark that ballot by themselves, to print it, to put it into a set of envelopes that are mailed to them by the county clerk, and to sign it themselves. So they'll be able to feel on the envelope, where is this that I put my signature, and then mail it back themselves, all without the help of another person, so that the privacy of their vote is protected, which has kind of been the missing piece in the accessibility right. And privacy realm for blind voters. So we're very excited about that.
You're using Braille?
No, it's not Braille. And what we learned from working with the blind and visually impaired community is that a really small segment of the blind and visually impaired population actually can read Braille. Oh. So what they often have is some sort of voice interactive technology with their computer that walks them through. Okay, now there's an election for this race, and the candidate is this, and the candidate is this. Press this to vote for candidate A, press this to vote for candidate B. Okay, you voted for candidate B. And it walks them through a listening process to mark their ballot. And then they put it in the envelope and sign it and send it back themselves.
One of the things that happens in many elections, for example, in a presidential election, you might have a large percentage of people voting for president, vice president, and you might have them voting for U.S. senator and representative, but then the down ballot races, like, they don't know who these people are. They're not sure, you know, how do you encourage people to inform themselves, to vote, to have those down ballot candidates really be meaningfully voted for?
I think there's a few pieces to this equation. I think first and foremost, there is a lot of information out there about who and what is on the ballot, but I think that it is hard for voters, particularly voters who are frankly all consumed with their daily lives. I mean, we've got people who take care of kids all day long and who have sick parents that need to be tended to and who have to work 2 and 3 jobs, right? It's hard to find the time to find the information, to educate themselves, and it's hard to know, I think, in this day and age, what are trusted sources. You know, if I were an average voter and I didn't necessarily know about, let's say, the League of Women Voters voter guide or something like that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily know, okay, what's a trusted source where I can find out about this? So with that being said, I would love to see a real full-blown civics curriculum reinstated in our schools. I think now students might get, you know, a semester or so of government and civics, but, you know, really I think it's important to start teaching government, how it works, what the offices are, what they do, and then make those connections for voters about how those things actually impact them in their daily lives. And I don't think that's a one-size-fits-all approach. I would love to see civics programs restored. I would love to be doing more out of this office and for county clerks to be able to do more out of their offices. Of course, elections are vastly under-resourced at all levels. And, you know, we're often so scrambling finance-wise to just meet the statutory and process demands of an election that, you know, the piece that gets left out is voter education and outreach, right? So I would love to see more investment, you know, potentially public-private collaborations, because even though I think the government is and should be a great educational source, it's not necessarily the best source for any given voter, particularly like we were talking about, for example, in our Native communities where there might be a distrust of government, right? So where do you get your information from is really important in that regard. We had recently been contemplating something called restoration of the straight party ticket, which really made voting functionality a lot simpler for voters if they were planning to vote for a majority of one party or the other. I think the feedback that we've received has actually been pretty negative on that, but the idea behind it would be to enable more of a simplistic voting process as opposed to, you know, needing to spend half an hour in the voting booth and going, you know, each race and marking the oval for each specific race.
We used to have that in New Mexico.
We did. And, you know, not to get on, you know, too far into the subject, but I my view of it is that it's a great tool for those who want to use it, and that nobody should have to or feel obligated or couldn't use that as well as, you know, go down the ballot and say, hey, I really like this person for judge and they're not in the major party I selected. But it's interesting just with sort of the recent discussion about this, like, you know, my suggestion that we should consider bringing it back. There has been a lot of really, you know, sort of negative view toward it. And it's interesting. I'm listening to the feedback. So we have to start thinking of other mechanisms that can help simplify the voting process at all levels. Because the last thing that we want it to do, and I think it's really important for government to do, is to really remove barriers to make it as simple as and easy as possible in our hectic daily lives that we live as Americans now, that we couldn't have contemplated living 50 or 100 years ago, to make sure that folks are able to easily, safely, and securely cast their ballots.
I spoke recently on this program to the former Secretary of State of Oregon, and it was so interesting because they have, I think under this gentleman, they changed to a all mail-in system.
Yes.
So every citizen, every voter gets their ballot in the mail, and then they have that ballot on their kitchen counter or whatever
right.
for weeks, and they get more down ballot votes.
Not like, surprising.
Because yep. people, like, if I can totally imagine, like, if it were on my kitchen counter, I'd be like, okay, now who is that, you know, running for dog catcher or whatever?
Yeah, and you have the time to do the research,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And their turnout overall is very high. Is mm-hmm. that something that New Mexico should consider?
Yes, we should absolutely consider it. I actually really like the model that they've implemented in Colorado, which is somewhat of a hybrid model. What they do is they mail a ballot to every voter, and then the voter chooses how they want to vote and return that ballot. So as you say, they could have it sitting on their kitchen table for a couple weeks and take their time, and they could put it in the mail, or they have drop boxes, secure drop boxes throughout the state where a voter, if you're driving to work, you can just drop it in a drop box, or you can even go to a vote center. They still have those, and you can walk in and you can go into a voting booth, mark your ballot there, and put it into a tabulator right there if that's what you choose. I kind of like that concept because it really emphasizes voter choice and what you're comfortable with. And I'll tell you, I hear all the time from voters, oh no, I don't vote early. I go on the day of the election and I go to my polling place because it gives them a sense of civic pride, right? And so I would love to consider something like that here. We do have to be cognizant and careful, again, of our rural and tribal voters. There was just recently a lawsuit that the state of Utah lost that had to do with the fact that there was some automatically mailed ballots to voters in their tribal communities, and their voters weren't receiving them because of challenges with mail service delivery in tribal countries. So we would need to think about how to address that shortcoming if we did that here. But I do think it's a wonderful idea. For participation and for voter choice. So we'll see how that goes.
Your office certified the software that allowed ranked choice voting in Santa Fe.
Right.
And that was, I mean, some people had mixed feelings about it. I still meet people say, I don't like that, you know, and a lot of people did like it. That's what we had. It was interesting.
Yeah.
What is your feeling about ranked choice voting as a concept? Is it good for democracy?
You know, that is such a good question. So a little bit of background. As you probably know, ranked choice voting isn't utilized in most places. There's a handful of places where it is, and it's utilized primarily in municipal elections where you tend to have a lot of candidates for a particular office, and it is, in a lot of respects, better than having a runoff election, right? It's better for costs. It's better for voter participation to only have to go to the voting booth once. And then, as you know, and as we saw play out in the Santa Fe election, and by the way, I'm a Santa Fe voter now, ever since I took this job, and I voted, you know, in the ranked choice election and got to test it out for myself. As you say, some people really like it. They really like the idea that you could kind of rank in order of preference and say, oh, I like this person the best and this second best, et cetera. And then some folks just like, you know, I just really want to vote for my one person, and that's all I want to do. Which, by the way,
they can do
under ranked choice voting if that's what they choose to do. I actually thought it went really well here. Once we got through the legal rigmarole of whether it should be allowed or not, the city of Santa Fe got immediately on board with I thought was a fantastic voter education program, tons of outreach, really useful information. And then I thought it worked in practice really well. I thought the city clerk did a great job. We knew by midnight on election night what the outcome of the election was. There's no need to do a runoff. I mean, you know, if we'd had to do a runoff election, we wouldn't have known for another month, you know, what the election outcome was. So I think it went well. I think it's worth continuing here. I think it's worth continuing to see if it can be implemented in other municipalities in New Mexico. I think the jury's still out. I think you don't know from just one election cycle whether something is the right thing or not, whether it's going to be what works for a community, whether the community trusts the outcome, whether they feel good about the outcome. But all signs, I think, point to this having been a very successful first implementation.
We've been talking about elections, and it's a subject close to my heart because I personally love voting, and I just think voting is so important, and it is, the for many people, the one way in which we do participate
right.
in our society and public life. Another thing that your office deals with is corruption and transparency and mm-hmm. financial disclosure and campaign finance and all this stuff. Now, your predecessor, former Secretary of State Diana Duran, was entrusted by the voters with administering laws to prevent corruption and ensure transparency, but then she herself was charged with, I think it was over 60 counts of criminal fraud, embezzlement, money laundering, all mm-hmm. these things. She pleaded guilty to some of them. I'm going to just take an educated guess that the oversight system that you inherited was not as good as it could be. Mm-hmm. There are laws requiring financial disclosure of our elected officials and the officials they appoint and spouses. And all of these disclosures are supposed to be submitted to your office. Mm-hmm. This also goes for financial disclosure for lobbyists. It's huge. Mm. How is that system working? How can it be improved? What are you working on?
So I think you're right. I mean, I think we have had, and my predecessor's awful story aside, you know, we've had this sort of torrid history in New Mexico of having, unfortunately, corruption in government. And you and I were speaking earlier today about trust in government. And for me, one of the crucial aspects of a healthy democracy is that the voters trust and believe in the system of government. And we cannot continue to have a healthy democracy with participation, with elected representation that reflects the views and values of the people without it. So in that regard, when I came into office, probably my first priority was to focus on the ethics piece of the job. And the Secretary of State is the chief ethics officer of the state for the reasons you described and others in terms of the responsibilities. There had been improvements made under interim Secretary of State Brad Winter. He had really let the staff start to take some ownership of the processes and to start to automate some things and to improve some things, but there's still a long way to go. One of the first things that we need to do, and we finally just received funding from the legislature, is to vastly improve our campaign finance information system. We have a so-so system currently that's not extremely user-friendly either for candidates and campaigns or for the folks, you know, the media and the public who are interested in finding out, you know, who's raising and spending money in New Mexico elections. So we need to improve that. And part of the system improvements will be to give us some internal tools to do some better regulation. For example, we're going to develop the system so that it will automatically flag things that are out of compliance with state law. Right now, unless you're randomly selected in an audit that we do a 10% audit after every finance period, there could be things in a campaign finance report that we would never know or find out about unless someone alerted us that they had noticed it. So creating some of these automated flags will give us a lot better tools to be able to reach out and say, hey, we noticed this. Was it a mistake? Would you like to fix it? Or because the goal at the end of the day is to have voluntary compliance. We want every elected official and every state official that has to comply either with financial disclosure or if you're a lobbyist with lobbyist disclosure or with campaign disclosure to be voluntarily compliant. We know that a lot of the problems that we have found where the law has been violated have been mistakes or unintentional. We want to give folks the opportunity to correct an error, even if the error was they took too much money. Okay, well, what do? Pay the money back, right? You know, that's one way to fix such a problem. But then it'll also give us the tools to be able to see patterns of willful violation of the law. So we're looking forward to that. I also want to take the opportunity here to encourage folks to get out and vote for the Statewide Ethics Commission constitutional amendment that is going to be on the ballot this fall. One of the challenges that we have in the Secretary of State's office with enforcement is that while we are charged with enforcement, we have very few tools at our disposal. For instance, I can't subpoena bank records. Only a judge can do that. For instance, I can't levy criminal fines, obviously, or criminal punishment, right? That's, you know, I have to work with the AG's office to do something like that. The Statewide Ethics Commission will be granted quite a few more powers in this regard in order to engage in enforcement. And it also takes, quite frankly, the decision and the discretion out of the hands of an elected official such as myself, who's, you know, I'm elected under a party banner, right? It will take the partisanship or the perception of partisanship, more importantly, out of the equation, because this will be a bipartisan independent commission. So I think that can go a long way to improving the process as well.
And that's very important. And I think we'll continue to talk about this on this program as we get closer to Election Day. But yes, voters will have the chance to vote on whether we have an ethics commission. And then if we do, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because there will still be a lot to be put in place to see how that is constituted. Mm-hmm. Will that remove your role as the Secretary of State's office to a different commission, or how does that work?
So that's a good question, and a lot of those details are going to have to be fleshed out in the enabling legislation. So if this amendment passes, and like most constitutional amendments, this amendment is fairly broad. When the amendment passes, it will be incumbent upon the legislature to pass the enabling legislation. In other words, how is this actually going to work in real life? And so some of our remaining questions that we will be working with the legislature to address will be, what is the continued role of the Secretary of State's office in this process? And more than likely, we'll continue to have the role of being the receptacle, if you will, for the filings and providing, you know, the campaign finance information system and doing certainly some of the voluntary compliance piece that we already have. But when it comes to a willful violation of the law that's not able to be remedied via voluntary compliance, I think that's when the Ethics Commission will kick in. But is there going to be a referral process? How is that going to work? Those are the kinds of details that need to be worked out in the enabling legislation.
And there's so much of this kind of thing where the devil is in the details.
Right.
I mean, I was reading, there's a terrific organization called New Mexico Ethics Watch, and I was reading some of their reports, and, you know, one of the things there, and you'd sort of never think of this if you weren't living and breathing this stuff, but, okay, you have to disclose if you have a business that's worth over $5,000, but the public doesn't end up knowing whether it's worth $6,000 or $20
million. Right.
And so there are things that really do make a difference in terms of what questions are asked and how they're asked and then how that information is put together.
Right.
That the public doesn't even have a, like, I don't even have a, I've been reading this stuff. I don't even really fully understand it. How do you get on top of that?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And I think what we are always striving to do in this office is balance our obligation as a filing officer and as a compliance officer with, again, to be frank, our lack of resources. I mean, we have a very small office. We have about 46, 47 full-time staff in the Secretary of State's office. Most of my colleagues have at least a couple of hundred. So I don't think I'm wrong in saying I think we have the smallest Secretary of State's office in the country for relative to the duties we perform, because not all secretaries of state do the same things. So I think one of the challenges with that is that really at this point in time, our duty is to get the form, to make sure it's filled out correctly, that all of the required information is there. As you know, we've started making those forms public. So they're on the internet now, and anybody can look at them. And actually, in addition to being a good transparency mechanism, what that's also very helpful with is that, you know, if there are folks out there that have knowledge of inaccuracies or, you know, omitted information or what have you, they can let us know.
Or hanky-panky of one kind or another.
Well, that's the thing. And so, you know, that's sort of the challenge, is we're so reliant on that right now. We are so reliant on, you know, investigations that really get spurred by a public complaint, because we literally do not have the internal resources to start looking into things and start researching them, right? And there's also a question of whether that's even what the law requires of us. But it is sort of, to your point about unintended consequences, it really is sort of an issue, because I think you look at the law and you say, okay, this is going to prevent, you know, some sort of financial conflict of interest if folks have to disclose this. But if there's no enforcement of that, then how are conflicts of interest going to be prevented? So it is a real challenge. I have and will continue to advocate for more resources on that front for this office, because that's really the next step, to hire investigators, you know, to be able to look more fully into these things, so that we're not just, again, like a receptacle for the information.
Yeah, I mean, there was another report from Ethics Watch on boards and commissions, and mm-hmm. something, I mean, there's like several dozen of them in the state. And there is a lot of potential for conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And only a very small percentage of those, first of all, it's hard to even know who is on all these boards and commissions.
Correct.
And then a small minority of those boards and commissions actually have full compliance with financial disclosure. So if there's like the New Mexico Gaming Commission, mm-hmm. and there are people who stand to profit who are on that board.
Right.
And we have factual information. There are people who purposely get on boards in order to further their self-interest, whether
sure.
it be something small or large. So again, there's so much potential for wrongdoing. How far are we in even really knowing, do you think,
mm-hmm.
what's going on? Which knowing is the step before
being
actually
doing
something about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think it's interesting that you bring up Ethics Watch. So it's exactly those types of organizations that we are heavily reliant upon here in the office, because until we were informed that there was this total shortcoming with regards to board and commissions members turning in their financial disclosures, you know, we were just simply unaware, right? And part of that is there is a, you know, separation of powers between the Secretary of State and the governor's office. You know, the governor is not required to provide us with a list of every single board and commission member. But now that we know this, this is something moving forward that we can do something about, right? So for the next opportunity, or I should say the next required time for these financial disclosures to be submitted, which will be next January, we will be able to work together with the new incoming governor to let them know, hey, moving forward, we want to be able to do outreach to these boards and commissions members to make sure that they get their financial disclosures. And can you work with us to make sure we know who they are and their addresses and things like that? But as you say, without knowing, how can you do something? The flip side of that coin is once you do know, it's really important to start doing something and put something in place. So we are doing that. And we've done that with everything that's come to our attention in that way. I think last year, Ethics Watch noted that, look, there's all these financial disclosures online now. This is terrific. We're going to go on the Secretary of State's website and look at this. Oh, look, there's all these people who have turned in their forms but didn't bother to check a box or didn't bother to put in required information. Hey, Secretary of State's office, did you know this was going on? Holy cow.
Yeah.
No, we didn't. Now we can do that. When we get a form, we can double check and make sure. And if not, we can go back to the person and say, hey, you need to finish filling this out. So to your point, once we know, we can do things. But we are really reliant, and it's really helpful to have these outside groups and outside eyes, and which is why transparency, one of the reasons why transparency is so important.
The Secretary of State, as you said, is an elected official from a party, and there have always been charges of partisan bias. I mean, many people remember the Secretary of State of Ohio, who was both in charge of elections and campaigning for presidential candidate George mm-hmm. W. Bush. How can this type of partisanship be prevented or at least mitigated?
I think about this a lot, and my approach to my job, and I did this when I was county clerk in Bernalillo County as well, is that needless to say, you have to leave your partisan hat at the door before you come in. And so what I mean by that is, you know, I do not engage in political activity in this office whatsoever. Any political activity that I engage in that I, you know, have to by virtue of being a candidate, I do it outside of the office with my own personal resources. And then when it comes to decision making, and here's the reality, any decision that I make in this office, 90% of the time, it's going to benefit one party or one party's candidates over the other. So what we have to do is we have to look at the law. I work very collaboratively with my staff, and we come up with an interpretation that we're all comfortable with, and we render a decision. And, you know, if I make a decision that favors the Democratic Party, sometimes it gets accused of being a partisan decision. If I make a decision that favors the Republican Party, usually you never hear anything about that. You know, and I think, you know, what anyone in this position has to do is just really have to look at the law and really take the specifics of who is involved or which party is involved out of the equation and say, if I make this decision and then a member of my party or the other party had a similar situation, would I make the same decision? And if the answer is yes, then it's the right decision. And if the answer is no, then it's the wrong decision. But it's hard because I know that's how I approach it, but I don't know that everyone would approach it that way. So transparency is important. Checks and balances are extremely important. Making sure that these decisions are fully vetted in a public way. For example, when we're doing rulemaking, we're extremely transparent about our rulemaking processes and making sure that folks know we're doing them and public comment and all of those things. Those are the things we can do now. Down the road, I'd love to see Secretary of State be a nonpartisan position. Down the road, I'd love to see Secretary of State be a publicly financed position, because then you're taking the campaign money piece out of the equation. But for now, this is kind of the best we can do. And again, I think having an ethics commission will help with that as well.
Maggie Toulouse-Oliver, Secretary of State of New Mexico, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican. An independent newspaper since 1849, the New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.